yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a-screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, last week we kind of summed up the economic legacies of Trump here over the past 4 years. We'd like to, at this show, talk about some of the political legacies that we're living with and going to have to live with some time as a result of those past 4 years. Trump is not going away physically. Well, physically he may be going away, but he's going to be there in the background politically as well. He'll lay low here for probably the rest of this year, you know, as long as they're holding over his head the Senate trial and just in general. But Trump will be back either at the head of his legions here or, you know, maybe in the background, putting forward another figure, a Cruz or somebody, who knows. But anyway, Trump is not gone. Trumpism is not gone. And what are the legacies that are not going to go away either, that are going to haunt us in some cases here for the next 4 years and who knows how long? I'd like to talk about that today as a sort of addendum to last week. You know, we talked about Trump's toxic economic legacies. Just to recap briefly, at the top of that list, of course, was his $4 trillion tax cuts, which even Biden has only talked about partially rolling back. And McConnell and Republican Senate senators will do everything they can to minimize that rollback. And the inequality, income inequality that has created, a lot of those tax cuts, just as the Federal Reserve QE programs have funneled trillions of dollars into investors and corporations that a good part of which they just redirected into the stock markets and financial markets and made themselves even richer. You know, we know about people like Bezos, Jeff Bezos, and Musk and Elon Musk and some of the others, you know, they've added trillions of dollars, trillions to their wealth here just since the past year. Well, that's partly because of the tax cuts, partly because of the programs of the policies of the Federal Reserve providing all the free money. So, you know, the tax cuts and the Federal Reserve free money, those are legacies, economic toxic legacies, because we're going to pay a price. Not only in income inequality exacerbating, but in financial instability as well down the road. Deregulation, the other big economic legacy of Trump, again, allowing businesses to do pretty much across the board anything they want to do. And that saved them a lot of money in addition, but gave them a lot of freedom to violate you know, basic health and safety and climate regulations and so forth. The failed trade war, Trump, particularly with China. And, of course, the management of the economy, the COVID, the gross mismanagement of the economy. You know, Trump has been pretty much AWOL for 6 months. The last 3 months, obviously, trying to overturn the election. But the U.S. government has been non-functioning for at least 6 months. You know, previous to his attempt to overturn the election, there was, you know, pretty much not really doing anything about the, you know, the entire government. Gross mismanagement, turning the whole COVID thing over to the states with no plan, with no support, you know, just total gross mismanagement. Those were the economic legacies, you know, the Federal Reserve, part of that. They're still with us. They're still with us. They, you know, the results of these policies are still hanging over us. you know, they're part of the total Trump legacy. But let's turn to the political legacies now. I'd like to talk about that. Also still going to haunt us for some time here. One is there has been a fundamental across the board, I don't know, a revolution or fundamental change in consciousness, political consciousness, at all levels. We have passed a threshold of sorts. It's not maybe quite that obvious yet, but it will be. The events of the last 3 months in particular, politically, the attempt to overturn the election, culminating in the January 6th mob attack on the Capitol building, which now is becoming obvious. It wasn't just a spontaneous mob. This was organized, you know. They'll probably never tell us the full details of to what extent this thing was organized here. They'll keep it under wraps, they meaning, you know, FBI and the government and so forth. But this was organized, and I think a lot of it from the White House, you know, the Stephen Millers and people like that, I don't doubt had a role. It wasn't just Trump saying, come to Washington on January 6th and, you know, go march on the Capitol there. And then people like Eric Trump and, some of the others that spoke there pretty much given a further boost to crash the gates at the Capitol. Right? The consciousness has changed as a result of all that. And when I say across the board, I mean, look, certainly the political elites of this country are shaken to the core as to what happened. And they know how deep it's really gone. You know, they're quietly trying to find out to what extent there was an inside support for this thing among the police in the Capitol, and that looks like, you know, fundamentally it did exist. And they're worried about, you know, within the police in general across the country and in the military, lower ranks, a lot of support for Trump and what actually happened. So the political elites, the Democrats and the traditional Republicans in Washington, clearly realize that something has happened and is happening. They're quite worried, maybe even scared. You know, they've had a taste now of what it's like for school kids to deal with a shooter coming into their house, their school, and shooting at them. You know, that has a profound effect on people's consciousness who are involved, and something similar has happened here. And the political elites are worried, and you see that the fact that they brought 25,000 National Guard to protect themselves on the inauguration just a few days ago. And there will continue to be a quiet search and purge, if they can, of federal police forces and the military, because the problem with Trumpism, which is really a kind of neo-fascist movement in this country, goes deep. It's out there, and it's deep, and that hasn't gone away. And I think the elites realize that as well. Now, what about consciousness change elsewhere? I believe that the radical right, and, you know, when I say radical right, I mean the Oath Keepers and Three Percenters, the Proud Boys and all of that, those and their followers, and also, you know, deep within the institutions here in Congress. We saw 130-some representatives and at least half a dozen or more senators allied with that movement, and still are, although they're hunkering down and they're trying to not be so obvious and maybe tacking publicly in the other direction to redirect any criticism of them. Those forces, particularly the street forces, saw January 6th as a confirmation of their tactics. I believe they think they had a victory. even though some of them will get picked off by the FBI now, I think they will look upon that, well, we successfully stormed the Capitol. Now, why can't we, if we need to at some point, do it again? Maybe not at in Washington, but, you know, maybe at the state capitol level, you know, in Michigan and other places, you know. I mean, those days will come, not right away, not until probably at the earliest next year, before the next election cycle, and certainly by 2024. But I believe the radical right consciousness has shifted as well, thinking that they can pull those kinds of tactics off successfully. I'm sure they see that as a success, even though, you know, the fallout for January 6th, and, you know, has caused that movement to go into hibernation a bit. But it's just hibernation. It will awaken once again at different levels, probably. So, you know, the radical right consciousness has shifted, just as the traditional elites have shifted. John Q. Public is now aware of, as they say, how fragile democracy is. You know, that's the term they like to use, how fragile democracy is. Well, yes, it is fragile. But people have realized and seen, I believe, they got a real education as to what is the role of the Electoral College in this country. You know, most Americans had and probably still do function under the misunderstanding that we have a direct vote, that, you know, you vote for whoever it is and whoever gets the most votes wins. Well, I think a lot of them, millions of them now see that, no, it doesn't work that way. We have an electoral college, which is really a kind of a bulwark against popular mobilizations. And the electoral college plays that role of sort of checking and stabilizing and rolling back if the popular rebellion is too strong. And of course, in this case, it was a right-wing popular rebellion. But, you know, progressives and leftists should take a lesson from this. I mean, just imagine if even Bernie Sanders had won. Do you really think that the Electoral College would not have been overturned? Even the Electoral College, which is a, as I said, bulwark against popular democracy, we now see that the Electoral College is not the last bastion of reversing a democratic election. We now see that there are ways that the Electoral College vote can be stymied, can be negated, can be reversed. It didn't happen. It came very, very close to happening. And I firmly believe if it wasn't the corporate Democrat Joe Biden involved in this case, that, you know, if it was Bernie Sanders, and certainly if it was a, you know, a more socialist, you know, maybe Ocasio-Cortez or someone like that, it never would have gone through the Electoral College. Somehow they would have found a way to reverse even the Electoral College vote and overturn it at the state level, because, you know, the Electoral College comes and votes, but you have the possibility that maybe some of the delegates, some of the electors can vote differently than their state popular vote mandates. You know, that's one way of reversing Electoral College vote. Another way was for the governor of the state to simply refuse to accept the Electoral College vote and appoint electors himself or herself, right? And in the red states, you know, that came pretty close in some cases. And as I said, I believe if it wasn't Joe Biden, if it was Bernie or somebody, they would have appointed their own electors. That's what Trump wanted them to do. He wanted them to appoint electors other than the Electoral College. When they didn't do that, Then the next step for overturning Electoral College decision is on January 6th when it gets to Congress. Congress has to sort of legitimize the Electoral College vote. And if you can stop that process of legitimizing the vote in Congress, well, then you overturn Electoral College again. So there's at least three or four ways even Electoral College vote can be negated. And, of course, Electoral College is all about negating popular voting anyway. Well, I think people now see, people see that there's a whole system of procedures here that exist, maybe not even in the Constitution, but according to the rules, you know, like a lot of Electoral Act of 1887 was involved here. There are procedures in which the popular uprising through the electoral system can be negated, overturned. And I think people see that. John Q. Public, many of them, many people still think it's a direct vote. But now I think they see the Electoral College and maybe even beyond the Electoral College, how the system can check and reverse even the popular vote as reflected in the Electoral College. In other words, yes, the democracy is fragile because the institutional arrangement of electoral democracy is such as it is. That's why it's fragile. You know, if we simply move to a one person, one vote, i.e. democracy, none of this would exist. None of these means by which to overturn the popular vote would exist. But neither of the wings of the corporate party, America, a.k.a. Republicans and Democrats, are ever going to move to get rid of Electoral College, let alone some of the other ways, clarifying the Electoral Act 1887 and eliminating the possibility that electors could vote other than their popular vote in their state, or governors can just reject the electors and point their own, or Congress could, as we almost saw, simply not legitimize the Electoral College. Right? We didn't get to the point, almost did, where that happened. But just think, if that had happened, if the mob had stopped the vote in Congress, ratifying or legitimizing Electoral College, what would have happened next? Well, somebody, some forces would have stepped forward, probably those 140 in the House of Representatives, and said, we got to rerun the elections in those key states that made the difference, right? Even though the Supreme Court never said one way or the other, you know, they never made a decision on that. Trump wanted them to, but they never did. So it's still open for possibility in the future. Some forces could have stepped in and said, okay, we got to do this or do that. And we're not recognizing the Electoral College. We came very close to that happening. And yes, it's very fragile, but boy, they just dodged the bullet. The elites just dodged the bullet in Congress. And that bullet, you know, would have gone to the heart of what was left of limited democracy in this country. But yes, they just dodged the bullet, but it's still very fragile. That gun is still loaded, you see? That anti-democratic, anti-institutional, democratic institutional, 45 caliber is still loaded. You know, it's been put down and put aside, but the bullets are still there. And hopefully we won't see it in 2022, I doubt it, but maybe 2024, if Biden cannot change the triple crisis in this country quickly. And that's going to take a major, massive fiscal stimulus bill here. The triple crisis still exists in this country. The triple crisis. I've been talking about that. Triple crisis meaning the COVID health crisis, which is still very much with us, You know, they've totally botched the rollout here of this vaccine, totally. One of the big failures of the Trump administration, AWOL, as far as dealing with COVID is concerned. And, you know, not, we saw that with Trump from the very beginning, right? I mean, the PPE did not exist in this country, personal protective equipment, right? It's been all offshored in recent decades, and we had to plead with the Chinese to please sell us some. The governors had to, right? And by the way, a lot of these were American corporations offshore, not just Chinese. But we didn't have the PPE. Trump didn't really activate the War Production Act. He could have, you know, like FDR did in 1941, one of his first executive orders. He didn't really do that. And what else did Trump do or didn't do? Right? The testing equipment, the test, and test kits. We still don't. We still don't have, you know, sufficient testing. And they've kind of ignored that whole issue here, right? They're not even doing the testing. They've ignored it. They bypassed it, and they said, well, we won't test. We'll just give everybody the vaccine. But that's been a big failure. You know, in other countries like Australia, the testing played a big role in keeping COVID down. And then the third big failure with COVID is the vaccine distribution. No plan whatsoever. Just throw it out there and hope the states do something with it, you know? And, of course, you know, the data shows that the 30 million doses that have been distributed to the states, only 3 million people have gotten both shots. Only 3 million. I don't know how many million more have gotten only one shot, but it's probably going to be wasted because they won't get the second shot in time. Where the hell is the other 20, 25 million doses? Where are they? They're out there somewhere. You know, I fear that maybe, since most of this is Pfizer and Moderna, particularly Pfizer vaccine, requiring a negative 100-degree freezer in order not to spoil, I wonder how many of these doses got distributed out there and just sort of went bad. And they're just sitting out there and they're afraid to inject people with it because the stuff is spoiled. I don't know. You know, maybe that's not true at all. But, you know, put together the fact that only 3 million doses out of 30 million. And, you know, put together that fact with, you know, what's going on and why we don't have any more left. Total failure. Total failure. Total mismanagement, gross mismanagement by the Trump administration with PPE, you know, with inhalators. Remember that problem at the beginning here with test equipment and now COVID distribution, right? The COVID crisis now, who knows about all these mutants? We're beginning to see a lot of mutations, and some of them are very bad mutations, like in the UK, South Africa, right? Very contagious. And, oh, they keep telling us, the vaccine will work against it. I'm not so sure that's proven yet. And, of course, the mutations are occurring faster and faster. And the COVID distribution is lagging. Now, we'll see whether the Biden administration can really turn that around. But that triple crisis, the COVID health crisis, is still very much with us. The other crisis is the economic crisis. Policy crisis. That's still very much with us. Look, this first quarter, January to March, is going to be an absolute economic bust. The fourth quarter, the data which we have in, showed the economy rapidly slowing down, especially consumption spending, household consumer spending, 70% of the economy, right? Retail sales contracting in November and December, credit card spending contracting. A rapid rise in first unemployment claims, initial unemployment claims from 1 million a week, which is bad enough, to at the end, early January here, 1.4 million, a 40% increase in unemployment claims. And then problems with our trade deficit, which reflect lack of production here. Trade deficit, you know, running almost $100 billion a month All kind of indicators in the fourth quarter show that a sharp contraction or slowdown, at least, of the economy has been occurring. And first quarter here is going to be even worse. Sources like Chase Bank Research has been predicting that we will have a contraction of the economy in the first quarter, a second double dip, you might say, which is very typical of great recessions, in which I predicted last March would be coming here, a double dip recession. We may be in it right now. The problem with the distribution of this $1.9 trillion announced proposal is that a lot of it is going to be rolled back, as I talked about in previous weeks. You know, the $390 billion in state and local government spending, well, the Republicans are going to go after that with clause and other elements like spending $170 billion to open the schools. They're going to attack that. They're going to probably try to roll back the $1,400 checks here and other provisions like the household child tax credits. They're not going to like that. And spending $40 billion on child care and $70 billion spending on emergency paid leave for workers. They'll attack all of that. And that $1.9 trillion will be closer to $1 trillion than $1.9 trillion, which means it will be insufficient. You know, if you look at what Obama did back when we had the first Great Recession, which was not as severe as this one, by the way, he spent $787 billion. And all the economists, you know, except those on the far right and Larry Summers, said, no, that's not enough. But he followed Larry Summers anyway. And he only spent $787 billion, and $300 billion that was tax cuts for businesses, which you can forget about. Another $100 billion long-term infrastructure that didn't hit the economy. So it was totally insufficient in 2009 for that recession. And we paid a price. Jobs weren't restored until 6 years later, 2015. And the jobs that came back, data shows, were mostly service, lower-paid jobs compared to the jobs higher-paid that we lost in 2009-10. Okay, so this recession, Great Recession, is magnitudes worse. And if they come up with only a $1.2 trillion stimulus here after cutting back some of the stuff, that's not going to be enough. No way. You know, last March I said we need a $4 trillion fiscal stimulus going to people who will spend it. Well, last March the CARES Act was only actual spending of about $1.3, $1.4 trillion. The rest went to businesses and they didn't invest it. So that was an insufficient stimulus last March. Well, Nancy Pelosi and others realized that that wasn't really a stimulus, that was a mitigation. In other words, by 8 weeks. And they were supposed to come up with a real stimulus after that. Well, they proposed a real stimulus in the HEROES Act, but Trump and McConnell and all those forces scuttled it, prevented it until late December, and then they passed, you know, a $900 billion proposal, which is what McConnell wanted all along. You know, McConnell all throughout last year says, I'm not spending more than $500 billion. And then his friend Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, went to the Fed and took back $400 billion that he had given the Fed that wasn't used because business wasn't borrowing and gave that to McConnell. And there's the $900 billion, right? So McConnell won that fight last year, and only now they're releasing $900 billion. But much of that $900 billion is really temporary. It's another mitigation bill to buy another couple months. You know, the unemployment benefits run out in early March from that December passage. And the $600 in checks will hardly go to cover back rents or mortgages and so forth. It's insufficient. So it's going to have very little stimulus here on the economy in the first quarter. Another problem with the $1.9 trillion Biden proposal is that if you're not going to see any of that until April or after. Yeah, they're already talking about, well, we'll get to legislating that in March, which means you're not going to see anything till April. So the first quarter this year, where we're looking at a double dip, is going to be a total bust. The stimulus, whatever the amount actually gets through after Republicans attack it, is not going to even hit the economy until the second quarter of this year. And then the other problem with the Biden stimulus is that a good part of it, hundreds of billions, is just a continuation of levels of spending. It's not net new additional continuation, for example, in the unemployment benefits, several hundred billion. Okay, they're supposed to continue under the Biden bill in March after the current unemployment benefits temporary extension expires. So, you know, we've got this $1.9 trillion that won't be $1.9 trillion, that won't take an effect till the second quarter starting, and that is really not as much as they say because it's just continued spending. And we see the continued spending is resulting in insufficient stimulus here and a contraction maybe of the economy this quarter. So this triple crisis in policy is another legacy, a legacy not just Trump, you know, goes back before Trump under Obama. Too little, too late. Too little, too late. That legacy continues. Certainly Trump has continued in that vein, even worse than the stimulus under Obama. When we have a crisis here that's several times worse than the 2008-09 crisis. Okay, so in other words, there's a political legacy. The policy legacy of insufficient stimulus that we saw under Trump likely is going to impact what we do with this Biden proposal, $1.9 trillion. Why am I not optimistic that this $1.9 will actually be $1.9 and it will be insufficient? Because of Biden talking about bipartisanship, which means with Mitch McConnell. Which means that, you know, the Democrats could push through all of it if they really wanted to, if they wanted to do a budget reconciliation in the Senate where you only need 50 votes plus one. They've got 50 plus one, right? Otherwise, you've got to get 60 votes in the Senate, which means you got to get a whole bunch of, you know, at least, 10 Republicans, which they probably can't get unless McConnell wants to release them, you see. So if you're going to say no budget reconciliation, it's going to take 60 votes, well, then you're giving essential veto power to McConnell and the Republicans in the Senate. You're giving them veto power, and they will use that power to gut the $1.9 trillion. Also an indication of bipartisanship is Schumer, Senator Schumer, now the majority leader in the Senate, has already agreed with McConnell that in all the committees, there will be a 50-50 membership, even. So you can't even get bills out of the committees to the floor, as I said, for a vote, unless you get approval by the Republicans. I don't see much different here in terms of Republican power in the Senate from what they had before. I think the Democrats are conceding them too much of a role, but that's what you get with bipartisanship. So these policies of insufficient economic stimulus, a legacy of Trump and before him Obama, will continue, I think. It's still with us. You know, that problem is still with us. So, you know, the first political legacy, as I said previously, is this massive change in consciousness in America, among the elites, among the radical right, and John Q. Public. Oh, and by the way, I think people realize now all this, you know, this spin about technology being a great democracy promoter now realize that technology is undermining democracy. I mean, primarily, you know, social media undermining democracy. So now we're going to get more censorship here in social media, and it will be used not only to attack the right, but to attack progressives and the left as well. The third big political consciousness shift, or consciousness, or political shift, political legacy, excuse me. The third big political legacy, apart from this massive consciousness shift that's gone on, apart from the policy continuation here of insufficient policy, economic policy, the third big legacy of Trump is the Republican Party and the likely split, I believe, that will come in the Republican Party. Not right away, but there is now a fight in the Republican Party that will intensify between the traditional elites of that party, who are going to try to take it back from the radical elements. But they're going to have a very hard time because these radical elements are embedded in that party and very strong out there in the state legislatures. They're going to lay back, of course, these elements here initially, but they'll reassert themselves again, certainly before the 2022 election. And at some point, there will be a split in the party. If the traditional elites get the upper hand, I believe the Trump radical elements will leave. And you might see if the converse happens, where the Trump forces maintain control and maybe even deepen control of that party, you'll see some of the traditional elites go independent, particularly in the political class there in Washington. They may become independent. Some may align themselves with the Biden Democrats. We may be seeing, possibly by 2022, more likely by 2024, three parties contending for votes in the Electoral College here by 2024. And then, of course, a big wild card we don't know, far less likely, though, is the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. If Biden fails to go big and achieve the policies necessary to stop the triple crisis in this country, and the Democrats get swamped in 2022 in the House and Senate, well, then you could see a split occur in that. In other words, we're on the verge of a possible political realignment going on, which is always indication of deep crisis when you have a political party realignment going on. Last time we saw that, of course, was in the 1850s as the crisis leading up to the Civil War. And the Whig Party disappeared, right? The Whig Party disappeared. The Republican Party rose on its ashes here. And there were all kinds of splits, you know, geographically and otherwise among the parties, the two parties, new parties. So it was a political realignment, party realignment. And that's a legacy of Trump. You know, Trump has driven not only this deepening radical, in some cases, neo-fascist elements in the Republican Party, opening the door for them and making it legitimate, and even himself doing everything he can to drive out traditional Republicans and put his people in place. He almost took over the party. He may have actually taken over the party. We'll see. That fight is still going to be fought, and it will intensify between now and the next couple years. Who controls the Republican Party? That's a legacy of Trump. That's an important legacy of Trump. Not just the shift in consciousness, not just the policy failure, but the political party realignment. That's a legacy, a consequence of Trump. Another political consequence, a legacy of Trump, of course, is the America's imperialist alliances around the world are in shambles. The U.S. is going to have to rebuild those relationships, particularly with Europe, and some countries in Asia that now are orienting more to China. The Europeans will never quite trust to give carte blanche lead to the Americans, the American capitalist elite and imperialist, as they had in the past. It will be a new kind of a relationship. Europe will already shows it's going its own way, signing agreements with China on investment, for example, probably developing its own international payment system here that they have in their back pocket. Certainly the U.S. will now not be able to stop Europe from deepening its imports of Russian gas. You know, that was a major offensive of Trump, but it's failed now. The U.S. just does not have the influence over Europe that it once did. Maybe over the U.K., which is in a deeper shambles than the U.S. economically and dependent upon the U.S. Far more than it ever was before. But they're going to have to put together all those alliances once again, not just with Europe, but in Asia, too, because there were signs, you know, that countries like Japan and even South Korea are orienting more towards China, Philippines. Well, Taiwan won't. Australia probably won't. And some others over there will remain loyal to U.S. International alliances and interests. But, you know, that's a legacy that we're going to see importantly here going forward. The U.S. Empire, global empire, economic empire in particular, has been shaken. Whether they can reestablish it, we will see. U.S. military power is still preeminent, but, you know, that alone is not power. Economic power is just as great, and political alliances are very important, too. And in both of those levels, the U.S. global empire has been fractured in some ways. So that's an important legacy. Screwing up the alliances, the capitalist global alliances, has been an important legacy internationally with Trump. And, you know, shaking up all the trade relationships as well. Europeans and others aren't going to trust the United States. Why? Because they don't know how long Biden's going to last here. The Biden regime, you know, the Biden regime could be overturned here in another 4 years easily, even in 2 years. So they're not going to risk that. They're going to proceed more independently in terms of their international relationships while they, you know, cautiously attempt to reestablish relationships with the U.S., political and economic. They're not going to put all their eggs in the U.S. basket anymore. They're going to, you know, caution and look for other relationships here, particularly with China, far more than they ever had before. A fifth legacy is that Trump has really given a big leg up to neo-fascist domestic forces in this country. You can't underestimate how significant that has been, not only growing their ranks, which are, but also legitimizing them and their strategies and their tactics and aligning with them. And that's not going away. You know, Trump may be on the sideline, maybe only temporarily, you know, because what did he say when he left office? You know, his last statement, you know, we'll see you again. Goodbye for now, but we'll see you again. What did he mean by that? This guy doesn't give up. He's not going away. You know, he'll be back. You know, right now they've got a sword over his head with the impeachment trial in the Senate, and they'll keep that over his head to make him behave himself. But at some point that will be resolved. Yes, he has other legal attacks going on, but, you know, he'll be able to raise money in other ways. And of course, he's already raised $250, maybe $300 million that he built his supporters on. that he can do whatever he wants with. That's a good start, right? So, you know, he's got money. And like most ex-presidents, you watch him. He's going to go around and give speeches for $250,000 a pop here or there, right? You know, maybe some of the businesses won't support him. He'll write a book, I'm sure, that will sell millions, tens of millions around the world, you know, and he'll make tens of millions at least out of that. This is what U.S. presidents do, you see. If they deliver for the people to put them in office, once they're out of office, they become multimillionaires with book deals, guaranteed book deals, and speaking at the, you know, quarter million a pop here and there, and setting up other business deals and sitting on boards of corporations and so forth. This is the way corruption works in the American system. You know, it's not like banana republics where they get to steal while they're there. They get rewarded nicely and join the multimillionaires club afterwards through all these various payback measures, right? But neo-fascist forces have been given a big boost here in many ways by Trump, and that's still with us. That's not going away. So if we summarize, you know, what are the five big political legacies of Trump? One, a fundamental change in consciousness across the board in all groups in this country. Fundamental. A split in the Republican Party that may take a physical split, political realignment, party realignments, eventually in the next few years. A continuation of the policies here of insufficient stimulus, you know, that have existed for some time and at the root of a lot of our problems here. Total mismanagement of the economy and the government. It's in shambles. The government, they're going to have to put it back together again here and get it functioning. They should be able to do that, but it's going to take some time, and it's not going to be easy for Biden and the traditional elites. But, you know, that gross mismanagement and undermining of the government at all levels here is going to have to be restored. That's a big legacy. The alliances, global political alliances in shambles, that's a legacy. And neo-fascist forces being given the big push here, that's the legacy that's going to be with us. So, you know, you look at these things and, you know, the effects of Trump have not ended on January 20th. The effects, political effects of Trump, are still very much with us. And as I said in a prior show, the economic effects are still with us. You know, the tax cuts, $1 trillion tax cuts, the income inequality exacerbation, deregulations. Well, you know, a lot of those could be overcome with executive order. But the trade wars, the trade relationships, the COVID mismanagement, and the Fed, Federal Reserve monetary policy, which is now pretty much the handmaiden of politicians and businesses to provide them with free money ad infinitum, right? Which leads to financial instability, excess debt, financial instability, and financial crises at some point. So that's what we're facing in terms of the legacies of Trump, politically and economically. And they're not going away. They're not going away very soon. And what we have is a major task for the elites that have been, traditional elites that have been restored now. And it's both wings of the traditional elites. You know, they are uniting with each other. You can see it in the relationship between Biden and McConnell. McConnell actually coming out and saying certain things about Trump, which is kind of a warning to Trump that you better behave yourself. You know, we've got this this trial hanging over your head here, and if you know you get out of shape here, we're going to really proceed more aggressively with that. So they're holding that over Trump's head, and Trump will go into political hibernation for a while, I think. Lay low, figure out what kind of support he has, and do what he can to support his forces within the Republican Party, and they will regroup. Trump is going to regroup, be quiet, lay low, regroup with the troops, see what he has here. And behind the scenes, the fight for the Republican Party will be going on and intensifying over the next year, 2 years. And it'd be interesting to see what the neo-fascist forces actually do. I think that you're probably going to find an attempt to unify these groups. Somebody will attempt to bring them together, you know, the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and so forth, because right now they're all fractured. All they can do is get together these big demonstrations and engage in futile physical assault, right, with no strategy after that. Someone's going to try to unite them into a force, which is, by the way, you know, historically in comparison, happened in Weimar Germany. You know, there were all kinds of radical right forces in the early 20s. You know, the Nazis were only one of many. And those forces got united eventually by the mid-1920s behind the Nazi Party, behind Adolf. And at that time, Adolf Hitler was not the guru, was not, you know, the leader that could do no wrong. He was a very popular speaker, a very effective speaker during that first half of the 20s. But once the Nazis had unified all these radical right movements throughout the country, then, only then did Hitler come to play a role as the leader who had the final and only say on everything and could do no wrong. In other words, the cult. Now, that did not happen until 26, 27 even. And after that had happened, and after all these groups had been unified under the Nazi Party, then, only then, did the Nazis make the big move electorally. And even then, they would not have proceeded and succeeded if they didn't have the support of the big capitalists, who saw when the Depression hit in the late 20s in Germany, it hit there first before the U.S., when they saw, you know, the great discontent and the rise of socialist and communist rank and file among the working class, only then did they really support Adolf and the Nazis and provide a lot of money for them and thought that they could control him and control that movement. But, of course, it turned out that they really couldn't. But the capitalists played the key role in allowing the Nazis, you know, to get that last mile into power. Well, you know, you look at American capitalists, and they're playing a role here with Trump. You know, people, you know, families like the Mercers and the Adelsons and Schwarzmans and all of those have funded Trump significantly. Mainstream media doesn't really talk about that much. They don't want to go there, you see. But there's money, big money power behind Trump and behind the radical right here. And, you know, they've tolerated Trump here for 4 years until the very last moment. You know? Why? Because Trump delivered for them big time. Multi-trillion-dollar tax cuts right away off the top. Deregulation of just about everything off the top. Going after trade relationships, which was a failure, but nonetheless, you know, they were willing to let Trump see what he could do in that regard to reestablish for another decade U.S. Hegemony in with its capitalist cousins and relationships. You know, they were willing to let him try that. You know, they viewed the immigration policy and all these other social policies is unimportant. And when Trump finally did not win the election, you know, they were willing, as long as it was Biden, you know, to switch and go with Biden. And they didn't really come out and attack Trump until after January 6th, or right before or right after. You know, if you look at the events of early January here, you had McConnell and those guys who were solidly behind Trump. When did they start to break with him? When the big capitalists began to come out and say, no, Trump, we got a problem with you. You know, acknowledge the fact that you lost. When did that happen? Only in January, right before and after January 6th. You know, groups like the Chamber of Commerce, National Association of Manufacturers, representative of big companies and so forth came out and said, no, you know, recognize the election. And certainly after January 6th, they came out even more strongly. And only then did the McConnells begin to break with Trump. Only after they clearly saw that those who financed their campaigns, their reelection campaigns, were not going along with it anymore. Then they began to change their tune. We can't ignore that fact, that behind all of this are certain very wealthy forces. You know, it's not as if they're standing off not doing anything. They're pulling the ultimate strings here, I believe. And they just pulled the one on Trump, right? Said, you've done what you needed to do for us. You know, you're a liability. Move on. And, of course, now he's doing that. And now they've thrown in with Biden and the Democrats. And so has McConnell in many ways. You know, McConnell and McCarthy in the House and others. You know, you still got some outliers, you know, who are not there like Cruz and Hawley. You know, they're just trying to deflect the criticism right now in the meantime. But, you know, the McConnells and the Bidens and the Schumers have closed ranks. They've closed ranks. Maybe that means there will be more of a stimulus coming out than I think. You know, maybe they realize that they have a bigger crisis on their hands, and you know, McConnell will give up some of his resistance to state and local government assistance and the $1,400, $2,000 checks, you know, and spending on schools. But maybe he'll give up some of that. I don't know. I'm going on the assumption that he's still going to oppose a lot of that, as he has before, but I could be wrong. We'll see, because the ranks have closed, you see. The ranks of the traditional elite have closed, and they're trying to present a united front, an attempt to deal with the triple crisis that exists that hasn't been dealt with the whole year here. And if they don't, they know that these neo-fascist forces out there in the hinterland will reorganize and come back even stronger by the next election cycles. They know that. So they're going to probably try to do something more than they have last year, and probably realize that what they did under Obama was insufficient and gave a root cause to the rise of Trump out there, you know, in 2016, culminating. You know, what happened in 2016 cannot be separated from the fact that Obama policies failed miserably for most people after 2009. And then the Democrats put the weakest candidate they possibly could have, which was Hillary Clinton, who botched her whole campaign. You know, they don't want to make that mistake again. And of course, they didn't by selecting Joe Biden. You know, I mean, Biden would not have won if it wasn't for South Carolina. And he would not have won South Carolina unless, you know, Obama was able to get Buttigieg and Klobuchar to jump out. Back out. So it was only, Biden versus Sanders. And Sanders couldn't mobilize his troops in the South the way he was able to do it elsewhere. And, you know, they anointed Joe Biden. And as it turned out, you know, he's probably the only one who could have defeated Trump given the Electoral College. So they're closing ranks, and we'll see what comes of closing of the ranks. And whether they'll engage in some emergency actions here out of concern that they know these neo-fascist forces are not defeated. They know that they're still out there. There's tens of millions of people voting for them. And they're not going to want to risk this again. So if they're smart, they will go big. And some of them have been talking about going big. But we will see. We'll see whether they really realize this in close ranks or whether we have still the same infighting between the Republicans and the Democrats in Congress and they go small. But we're living with these political legacies here for the next 4 years. They're not going away, just as we're living with the economic legacies of Trump. On net, Trump has been a disaster, not only for most Americans, but he's made the ability to rule of the traditional elites in this country much more difficult. And, of course, he's shaken their global hegemony, economic empire here as well. So we'll see whether they could restore it or whether they'll fail to restore it. But that's the question. And that's the task that we're going to be seeing from now on. Okay, that's it for today. I'm sure next week we'll be talking more about the measures that I predicted here. Sid Wilson, the robber burns straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets, they're screaming now.